Shalom, welcome to Ask JTF. This is the program in which we attempt to answer questions from our great JTFers. I'm Chaim Ben Pesach from the Jewish Task Force. Before we begin, this program is dedicated to a refuah shlema, complete recovery, for Sharon Mitman, Shlomo Ben Sara, and Dorit Bat Sara, and to Ilui Neshamot, elevating of the souls, for Malka Bat Meir, Allegra Bat Shlomo, Daniel Nankin, Victor Chazdai, Pesach Zeh Ben Dov, Lunita Adler, Shifra Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Barry Hoffman, Harav Mir Kahana, Harav Binyamin Kahana, Tzipora Fegi Bat Liba, Yosef Ben Meir, Robert Mitman, Dennis Shore, Helen Friedman, and Charles Zolot. I want to speak about something that we have spoken about in years past, but it's very important to remember that there was a figure in Jewish history named Ben Hecht. Ben Hecht was the Hollywood producer and director who created films like Gone with the Wind, a brilliant Jewish director and producer, and an assimilated Jew, by the way. He was intermarried, he was assimilated. But when he learned about what was happening to the Jews during the Holocaust, he immediately decided to take action to try to save the Jews during the Holocaust. And he worked with Peter Berkson and with other Jews that were Jabotinsky right-wing activists in order to try to save the Jews. And they formed the only group that did anything during the Holocaust. The only group that really worked to try to save the 6 million was the group created by Ben Hecht and Peter Berkson. Now, let's understand something. Before Ben Hecht got involved, the group that was trying to save the Jews during the Holocaust was completely ineffective, was unable to accomplish what it wanted to accomplish. Ben Hecht was involved mainly in fundraising. He also wrote a play which was shown at Madison Square Garden and created other activities. But the activities were only possible because Ben Hecht became the fundraiser for the organization. He began to raise money in order to make the organization effective. We need a Ben Hecht today. Ben Hecht saved hundreds of thousands of Jewish lives during the Holocaust. He was the one that was responsible for financing and organizing the Wallenberg mission that saved tens of thousands of Jews in Hungary. And many other rescue missions were funded and organized by the Ben Hecht organization. If he had not raised this money, if he had not been involved, in addition to over 6 million Jewish men, women, and children who were brutally murdered during the Holocaust, hundreds of thousands of other Jews would have been murdered. But that wasn't the end of the story. That's just the beginning of the story. After World War II ended in 1945, Ben Hecht became the chief fundraiser for Ha'Irgun Hatzfai HaLeumi, which is known by the acronym Etzel, the Underground Freedom Fighting Organization. Menachem Begin was the commander of Etzel. And this underground freedom fighting organization was responsible for driving the British Nazis out of the land of Israel and creating a Jewish homeland again after 2,000 years. In other words, the redemption of the world, the redemption of Israel and the redemption of the world after 2,000 years, which began in 1948 and which will eventually culminate with the coming of the Messiah and the Messianic era. That will eventually come. But this started in 1948 when we had a Jewish state again. Ben Hecht is the one who funded the underground group that made the creation of Israel and the resurrection of Israel possible. If Ben Hecht had not entered the picture and he raised over $5 million in the 1940s, $5 million, that was a lot of money in the 1940s, for Etzel. So, let's understand something. Ben Hecht was a historic figure who changed Jewish history and world history profoundly by getting involved and being willing to help. JTF needs a Ben Hecht so badly. We've always needed a Ben Hecht. But now that we have this tremendous threat of a Palestinian state being created in Judea and Samaria, where Israel would be returned to borders that are only 6 to 9 miles wide, where Israel would be facing suicidal concessions that could lead to another Holocaust, God forbid. We need a Ben Hecht to save us now, because the only people on the ground that are confronting this terrible threat are the Hilltop Youth, the heroic Hilltop Youth. And if we had the funds, if we had just a budget of, let's say, $1 million a year or $2 million a year, That would change Jewish history. $1 million a year, $2 million a year. You know what a joke that is in terms of today's modern Jewish establishment organizations? You know how many hundreds of millions they spend on hurting the Jewish people, on promoting assimilation and intermarriage and insane Jewish concessions and every Chilul Hashem, every desecration of God's name under the sun that the Jewish establishment organizations are responsible for? They only harm the Jewish people, the Jewish establishment organizations. Almost everything they do is bad for Jews, and they raise hundreds of millions of dollars. And at one point, before we had this raging Jewish assimilation, in one point, when in the 1970s, 1980s, they were raising billions of dollars. The UJ Federation, they were raising billions of dollars. Now it's hundreds of millions because the Jews have, because they've succeeded in so destroying the Jewish people in America and so watering down the Jewish people. 90% of American Jews aren't even Jewish anymore, don't even want to be Jewish. So they raise huge sums of money to harm the Jewish people. We need $1 million or $2 million to save the Jewish people. We could literally save the Jewish people and save the state of Israel and change Jewish history forever. I urge everybody watching this program to make a contribution to the Hilltop Youth, to the Heroic Hilltop Youth, to go, and I'm going to tell you how you can do it in a moment, the two ways you can do it. You can do it online, or you can do it by sending a check or a money order through the regular mail to our post office box. But I urge you to do this. All of our 100% of our budget, our entire budget is devoted to the Hilltop Youth. 100% of our budget. We don't have any paid salaries in the United States with staff. We have all volunteers. I don't get any money. In fact, I give out of my own pocket, whatever. And I'm not a very rich person, but I give out of my own pocket. And I'm going to be giving I'm giving most of my savings, and most of what I have in my life will be going to this cause, and I'm already giving. So we don't get any salaries here. We give. We all of us who are involved as volunteers even give. Everybody here can give something. Every donation will be appreciated. If someone can only afford to give $10 or $100, okay, $10, $50, $100, $36, whatever. If someone can afford to give $1,000, so much that would be so much more helpful. If someone can afford to give $10,000, that will go a long way in helping the Jews in Judea and Samaria, because, you know, they live in one-room wooden shacks with their families, with, in some cases, some hilltop communities like Ramat Migron, for example, they don't have running water, they don't have electricity, and in the freezing cold, they live in one-room shacks on hilltops with babies and children. You can make a tremendous difference if you give them a $10,000 donation or a $1,000 donation. If you can't afford that or you don't want to give that amount of money, give something, and give something on a regular basis. And if someone would give us a really big donation, $100,000 or $1 million, we could change Jewish history with $1 million. We've given them over $200,000 in the past half year. Past 6 months, we raised over $200,000 for them, which is a joke. Over $200,000 for dozens of these hilltop communities? That's nothing compared to what's needed. But that has made a tremendous difference, because before we came into the picture, before I discovered that this emergency situation requires that we put our entire budget and our entire effort into this, before I discovered this 6 months ago and got into contact with these people so that we could put our entire budget and our entire focus into this, before that happened, they didn't have columns in the Shabbat newsletters where they reach huge numbers of Jews in the religious nationalist community. They didn't have the type of support that they now have in the religious nationalist community, because they reach people with their message, thanks to JTF funding their columns and funding their public relations campaign. They didn't have roads. They walked knee-deep in mud. We built roads for them. We built roads connecting their communities. We built roads connecting the Jewish hilltops in Binyamin with the Jordan Valley, which prevents a contiguous Palestinian state from coming into being. And by the way, there is no Palestine. There are no Palestinians. That's all a historic myth and a lie. Let's be clear about that. But we built roads for them. And we got them all types of things that are so essential. We got them gloves. They didn't have gloves and they were working. And they had gloves when their hands were getting all wet in the freezing December and January weather. And they'd work for hours with their hands freezing, endangering their health and their lives because of their devotion to the land of Israel. We got them gloves where their hands don't get wet and which keep them a little bit warmer when they work. And clothing which helps them. And enabled them to store 350 gallons of water because they don't have running water. They have to buy water. Before we came into the picture, every single day they had to run to buy water and run, make trips back and forth to buy water. Every single day they would spend their mornings running back and forth just to get enough water so that they would have water for drinking and for washing and for cleaning dishes and so on. Now they have 350 gallon tanks to bring in water. And now they have a tractor to drag the 350 gallon tanks in. And now they have, if one pickup truck, because they have only used, everything they have is used because they can't afford to buy new. If one of their pickup trucks breaks, which happens because they use it a lot, they have a second pickup truck. They have two pickup trucks on this particular yeshuv now. We're talking about Ramat Migron. Now they have two pickup trucks. We bought them another pickup truck. We repaired the second pickup truck. We bought them a tractor, as I mentioned, which is very important for expanding the settlement and creating more land and creating agricultural possession of the land so the Arabs can't come in and take it over and claim the land. Because where the Hilltop Youth come in, the Arabs are unable to come in and grab the land. If the Hilltop Youth weren't there, the Arabs would take over everything. Everything. It would be all over. Without the Hilltop Youth, there would be a Palestinian state right now in everything but name. They would just have to declare it and the world would have recognized it. The whole world would eventually recognize it. First of all, the whole world is willing to recognize it. Almost the whole world is willing to recognize it right now. And that would create tremendous pressure on the United States, and eventually the United States would recognize it, and eventually the government in Israel would recognize it. That's the way things are, and that's the way things work, and there's no question that that is what would happen if the Jews weren't there. If the Jews weren't there, there's no question there'd be a Palestinian state. No doubt about it, it would be inevitable, it would be unavoidable. You wouldn't be able to stop it. AIPAC and all these Jewish organizations support a Palestinian state. Most of these Israeli political figures in the Israeli establishment, they support a Palestinian state. And the ones who claim to be against it, like Naftali Bennett, in reality are lying. They're for it. They say, well, okay, but Section A and Section B and this section of Judea and Samaria, we will allow the Arabs to have. They're supporting it. Very few Israeli leaders are saying, we want all of Judea and Samaria to be part of the land of Israel. We're against giving it to the Arabs. Very few of them will say that because they don't support that. So we are on the verge of losing everything unless we support the Hilltop Youth. They have to win this battle. And if a Ben Heck came into the picture now, if we could just find somebody like that, we could save the land of Israel and save the Jewish people from a terrible tragedy. When you could be changing Jewish history forever. Are you crazy? Are you insane? This is your chance. There is no other cause and no other issue where with a set amount of money we can literally on the ground right now save Israel and change Jewish history. The results are immediate when you give to this. The results are immediate. They immediately get all types of new things. I mean, we buy them horses. We buy them. We help them with their animals that they have there. That they have animals. They have sheep and goats and horses, and I mean, we're helping them, and the results are immediate. All the leading rabbis in Israel have said, the leading rabbis in the religious nationalist community have said that we must support them. Without them, we're in a lot of trouble. The leading rabbis have said this, and these are establishment rabbis like Harav Chaim Drukman, who is an establishment guy, and other establishment rabbis have all said this. We've got to support them. And it wasn't easy for him to say that because the Hilltop Youth are not part of the establishment. And And all of our enemies confirm this. All of our enemies, the European Union, the State Department, the UN, George Soros, all the leftists, the first thing they demand whenever there's talk of negotiations or a Palestinian state or any negotiations or settlement, the first thing they demand is removing the hilltop youth outposts. They call them machazim, outposts. In Hebrew, machazim. That's the first thing they demand. This is your chance to forever change history, to save Israel and the Jewish people from a horrific tragedy. Do you want Israel to be 6 to 9 miles wide? Do you want a Palestinian state in Judea, Samaria, and eastern Jerusalem? We are moving in that direction unless the hilltop youth win this battle. They're the only ones fighting against this. They're the only ones putting their lives on the line. It's the only place where you can get real results, not declarations and talk about Judea and Samaria and Jewish settlement. That's all baloney. It's all a bluff. The only ones who are not a bluff are the hilltop youth. The only ones who are not a bluff. Everyone else is a bluff. So wake up. And if there are Jews out there with real resources, with the real money to make a difference, here's your chance to change history. And those of you who don't have $1 million to give us, but if you have $1,000 or $100 or $10 or $25, you can help us. This means a lot for yourself, for your family, for the people you love and care about, because what you do for them, this will influence how God views you, how Hashem looks at you, and for the Jewish people and for the world. So, again, we appeal to people, and that's what we're looking for. And you know something? Aside from money, why don't you put us on other sites, put our videos on other sites? I don't know all of the sites, but put them on other sites and spread the word and do something. Act to make a difference, to create a difference and create support for us and create new support for our English movement, and if you can, if you speak Hebrew, for the Hebrew movement as well, if you can, if you speak Hebrew. This is what we're called upon to do at this critical time. Don't let the hilltop youth down, because they're not letting us down. Give them the backing they need, and let's show them and the whole world that their fight is our fight. Okay, we're now going to go to our questions from our great JTFers, Bezrat Hashem, God willing. And we start off with, let's see what we have here. We start off with the great Hirvatsky Noachide, who writes, and I quote, "One, the general rule is that Jewish obligations are more restrictive and numerous. Can you give an exception where the Torah law for Gentiles is more restrictive than for Jews? And two, can you explain the reason for the restrictiveness?" Yes, there are examples, and what Hirvatsky is referring to is the fact that, for instance, the Jews have 613 commandments, Taryag HaMitzvot, 613 commandments. The Noahides have a minimum of 7 commandments. There are other commandments they can also observe, but a minimum, their minimum in order to be righteous, considered righteous Gentiles, is 7 commandments, a lot less than the Jews. So you would think that there's much less restriction, and even in terms of obeying the 7 commandments, there are aspects that are less restrictive than it is for the Jews. The Jews, it's usually in most cases, the Jews face greater restrictions than the righteous Gentiles, because the Jews are supposed to be a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests, and so they have to abide by a very high standard. But there are exceptions to the rules. There are areas where the righteous Gentiles, where the Noahides, the people who follow the laws of Noah, actually have greater restrictions than the Jews. For example, in the area of abortion. Abortion is forbidden for both Jews and Gentiles. But for the Gentiles, for B'nai Noach, there is a death penalty for abortion. Ben Noach, he or the woman or the people involved who carry out an abortion, they can face the possibility of a death sentence. You don't have that for Jews involved in abortions. So the restriction on abortion is even greater, and we're going to explain why. By the way, in practical terms, no Ben Noah has ever been executed by any Jewish court. So in practical terms, in terms of how this is in practice, how this is actually carried out, this is mostly an attempt to show the severity of these issues, although, you know, they may come when they're actually, these laws will be implemented, but even when you had Jewish control in the land of Israel, for instance, B'nai Noach, there is no record of any Ben Noach ever being executed by any Jewish court or any death penalty decision actually being handed down against any Ben Noach. So in practice, this is because we also have very strong laws of evidence and how you prove and under what circumstances you actually carry out a death penalty, very strong requirements in Judaism. So no Ben Noach has ever actually been executed. But technically, they can face the death penalty. They can face the maximum possible punishment of the death penalty for having an abortion, for instance, or for being involved in abortion. And the purpose of creating at least that technical maximum possible penalty is to send a very strong message about how serious the sanctity of human life is for Jews and for Gentiles, how serious it is. And the Gentiles have an even stricter and more severe possible punishment, because the Gentiles have not lived for thousands of years with a tradition of reverence of human life like the Jews have. So they you have to have a more severe possible punishment and a more severe message, because they lived in cultures and in societies where you didn't have this tremendous message of the reverence for human life. So abortion is an example where the rule potentially, technically, is stricter for the Gentiles, even though, again, it's never been enforced. Stealing. A Gentile who robs or steals can be put to death. And a Ben Noach who robs or steals can be put to death, can technically face a death penalty. For striking a Jew. A Gentile who hits or strikes a Jew can face the death penalty. We saw Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, the greatest human being ever to live, we saw that he killed the Egyptian who was striking a Jew in Egypt. And that's why he had to flee Egypt. So there are restrictions that are more severe. Jews do not face the death penalty for striking a fellow Jew. And Jews do not face the death penalty for stealing. And Jews do not face the death penalty for abortion. Harambam, Maimonides, says that violation of any of the seven laws of B'nai Noach carry a death penalty. Any of the seven laws, that the B'nai Noach must abide by the seven laws or face the possibility of a death penalty. Again, this has never actually been implemented, and in practice, it's not something that has actually been carried out. And how much it would be carried out is questionable. But the purpose is to give a very strong message to people who enter into the covenant of being B'nai Noach, of being under Hashem's control, because B'nai Noach are children of God now and following God's laws. God has laws for the Jews and God has laws for the Gentiles, and B'nai Noach are also following God's laws. Even though they're not Jews, they're following the laws of Judaism for the Gentiles. So they are under God's laws. And the God of Israel is their God. Just as much as God of Israel is the God for the Jews, the God of Israel is the God for B'nai Noach as well. So they have to be taught the severity of these offenses, because they lived in cultures that were violent and brutal many times, and sadistic and selfish and materialistic, whereas the Jews at least had the teaching from the Torah for thousands of years that taught Jewish values. The Gentiles did not have that benefit, and so there has to be a more severe message sent on these issues to the Gentiles. I hope that answers your question, Hirovatsky. And now we go to our friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is your favorite, least favorite Jewish holiday? Do you think that Passover is the best Jewish holiday? Unquote. I love all of the Jewish holidays. All of the Jewish holidays. Yes, Pesach would certainly be one of my favorite Jewish holidays. But I also love Sukkot. Sukkot is where we eat in the Sukkah and stay in the Sukkah, the tabernacle. I love that holiday, Sukkot. And Simchat Torah, Shmini Atzeret. I love those holidays. And Shavuot. They're all wonderful. I don't have any least favorite Jewish holiday, but I love all of the Jewish holidays. I love everything about our magnificent tradition, our magnificent Jewish traditions. Thank you very much, Joe. And now we go to Yimach Shmo to Islam, who writes, and I quote, "Why does Russia want to invade Ukraine?" Unquote. Okay, great question, and something that's certainly on everybody's mind. Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, and the Russian leaders want to recreate the Soviet Union. They want to recreate the Soviet Empire. That's literally what they want. They want to take over Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. They want to move in and take over the areas that were once controlled by the Soviet Union. That's their goal. And Ukraine is the largest country that broke away from what was part of the Soviet Union and became independent, and they want to put an end to that. So that's their goal, and they're willing to achieve it with the greatest brutality possible. And the Russians, of course, when they are involved in war, are very brutal, sadistic, cruel people and cruel invaders. But we don't have any side in this particular conflict because the Ukrainian Nazis, the Ukrainians, that is a Nazi nation, and the Ukrainian people are a Nazi people who murdered hundreds of thousands of Jews during the Holocaust. And they will never be forgiven. It will never be forgiven and never forgotten, the crimes they committed against hundreds of thousands of innocent Jewish men, women, and children. There is no mechila, there is no forgiveness for mass murder against the Jewish people. There can never be any forgiveness or forgetting of that type of crime. And their Nazi grandchildren, who are the current generation in Ukraine, worship the Ukrainian Nazis who did that during the Holocaust. The Ukrainian Nazi regime during World War II is universally revered as national heroes in all their schools, and their streets are named after Ukrainian Nazi leaders who murdered the Jews. And all their schools teach that they're heroes. They worship these Ukrainian Nazi leaders who murdered the Jews during the Holocaust. And that's why you see Ukrainians marching around with swastikas and openly praising Hitler and the Nazis. I mean, this is something that happens in Ukraine and is very common. So there's no question, we have no pity or sympathy for the Ukrainians, and Jews who live in Ukraine or in Russia are mentally unbalanced. Mentally unbalanced. Just like Jews who live in Germany are disgusting, mentally unbalanced traitors. How can you live in a country that murdered so many of your people and that wanted to exterminate your people? Especially now that we have a Jewish homeland. The vast majority of Jews in Ukraine left, Baruch Hashem, and they're not in that filthy, cursed country anymore. Just like the vast majority of Jews left the cursed country called Russia, Baruch Hashem, thank God. Thanks to the JDL and the Kahanists who led a campaign to free them from the Iron Curtain, from behind the Iron Curtain. But the Jews who remain, the minority of Jews who remain, it's disgusting beyond words. We don't support either side. We wish the best of luck in both sides. They should kill each other. They should destroy each other. It should be seven times on their head what they did to the Jews, at least seven times as much, because the Jews were innocent and they're not innocent. They deserve worse punishment than the horrible, monstrous crimes they committed against the Jewish people. In Babi Yar, they made the Jews dig mass graves and then threw the Jews into the pits, into mass pits, and buried Jewish men, women, children, babies, little babies, buried them alive, laughing. Laughing while the Jews were choking on the soil that was being thrown on them as they were being buried alive. And the soil after they buried these tens of thousands of Jews in this mass pit in Babi Yar, the soil kept moving for 10 or 15 minutes as the Jews desperately struggled to breathe. I don't know how they survived even 10 minutes in that, but even 10 minutes later, witnesses said that the soil was still moving as the Jews desperately were trying, gasping for breath as they were suffocating and choking on the soil. That's the Ukrainian Nazis. We will never forgive what they did to our brothers and sisters. We will never forget what they did to our brothers and sisters. And any Jew who forgives or forgets is a traitor to the Jewish people. A traitor. Thank you very much for your question, Joe Gutfeld. I'm sorry, Yimach Shmo to Islam. Thank you for the question, Yimach Shmo to Islam. Joe Gutfeld asked questions about the Jewish holidays. And now we go to another good friend of ours, Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "Your view of the John Kennedy assassination, do you believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone? I believe he acted alone," unquote. I think he did. I think he did. Now, people say, well, but Jack Ruby, whose original name, by the way, was Rubenstein, Jack Ruby killed him the next day, on November 22nd, 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and also a Texas policeman was killed also by the shots fired from Lee Harvey Oswald. And then on November 24th, 2 days later, as he was being led through the police station in the basement there, Jack Ruby came and shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And so they said, well, you see, because Jack Ruby had connections to the mafia, and so they say, you see, this was a mafia organized crime, they were involved, it was a conspiracy. Jack Ruby was mentally unbalanced. Jack Ruby was mentally unbalanced. He had a history of being mentally unbalanced. He physically attacked at least 25 incidents where he physically attacked people who entered his, he ran strip clubs and other type of clubs in Dallas, and he was involved with organized crime. But he used to beat people who came into his club for no reason. I mean, he was just out of his mind. He was crazy. He used to have an explosive temper and was irrational many times. And his mother spent many years in a mental asylum, and he had a long history of mental illness in his family, and he was mentally ill. And so he thought he was doing something. He said, he killed the president. I'm going to get him for killing the president. Now, he was crazy. But I think that Lee Harvey Oswald did act alone, despite the fact that, oh, this is the ultimate story where all the conspiracy buffs, all the UFO believers and conspiracy buffs, and the people that are against the vaccines, all of them, oh, they love to seize on this one. And there are times in history when there are conspiracies to assassinate, but in this case, I don't think that was true. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to Ram Sheva Sheva Ephes, and I'm going to quickly read his question in Hebrew and then take a couple of minutes and then translate it. Ram writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim Hayakar Mashlomcha Haya Achla Mifkash Zoom Gam Shalachti Lecha Bameil Et Haklatat Sichat HaZoom Shelanu Madatcha Leargen Shuv Sichat Zoom Ki Ze Haya Kef LaAnashim Sheli Bechlet Hem Omrim Sheata Achla Gever VYehudi Tzadik. And Ram is saying to me here that we had a Zoom conference for Israelis in Hebrew, and that the people enjoyed it, and what do you think about doing it again? Gamani neneti meod Ram veAni chashavti sheze haya nifla veNedaber al ulai nase etze beAtid gam ken. Ani choshev sheulai ken nase etze beAtid yechol liot. And Ram now, and I said that maybe we will do it again in the future, and that I enjoy doing the Zoom very much as well. Ram now writes, and I quote, Yesh li kama she'elot, ma da'atcha al ha-milchama bein Rusia levein Ukraina. He asked me about the war between Russia and Ukraine, which I already discussed that with the question from Yimach Shmo to Islam. So I'll tell that to Ram. Ram kivar dibarnu al ze b'she'ela kodemet. As ani kivar amarti ma dati legabei ze b'she'ela kodemet. And Ram now writes, Hayim ata be'ad giyus hamonim laritza sheli v'shel anashim sheli la'kneset b'primary shel ha'tzionut ha'datit. איך אפשר לשנות את בגץ והתשקורת השמאלנית של הרשעים, מה דעתך על נתניהו שהיה שר האוצר, מקווה שיהיה לך תשובות טובות באהבת ישראל, רם מאיר אברהם. And he asked me about raising money for his run for the Knesset, and for that he wants to run for the Knesset, and that how are we going to change the left-wing news media and left-wing Supreme Court, and what is my opinion on Netanyahu as Treasury Minister. We're exceeding two questions here, though, Ram. I have to tell him that in Hebrew. Ram, כמו שאתה יודע, יש לנו הגבלה פה של רק שתי שאלות. יש לך כמה וכמה שאלות מעבר ההגבלה הזאת, שתדע. בבקשה, בעתיד, בבקשה, אנא תשמור על הכללים פה, כי אם ניתן לך לשאול כל כך הרבה שאלות, כולם יעשו את זה, וזה לא יהיה טוב לתוכנית שלנו אם תהיינה לנו יותר מדי שאלות. גיוס כסף בשבילך לרוץ לכנסת, רם, אני מגייס כסף אך ורק לנוער הגבעות עכשיו, זה מה שאני חושב שצריך לעשות, אתה יודע את זה, זה מה שחשוב עכשיו. לגבי התשקורת והבגץ, כמובן שצריך מהפכה פוליטית כדי לשנות את זה, וזה משהו שדיברנו על זה הרבה פעמים, וזה מה שצריך, וזה לא משהו שיקרה מחר, זה ייקח זמן, אלא אם המשיח יבוא מחר. ולגבי נתניהו כשר האוצר, הוא כן עשה כמה רפורמות כשר האוצר, אבל הוא כבר כל ההתקדמות שהייתה באופן זמני כשהוא היה שר האוצר, הוא כבר הסיר את כל זה, ואנחנו כבר הלכנו אחורנית שוב בגלל המדיניות שלו מאז. אני מודה לך, רם. And I told him that Netanyahu, as Treasury Minister, that Netanyahu did do some reforms, but we ended up going backwards after that. Okay, and now we go to our other good friend, Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, one, you previously said that MLK Jr., Martin Luther King, didn't make anti-Semitic remarks associated with other blacks that did he himself ever make anti-white remarks, or did he associate with other blacks that did? And then you ask about his father and his son, did they make anti-Semitic remarks or associated with other blacks that did, or anti-white remarks? I'm not aware of anti-white or anti-Semitic remarks made by Martin Luther King's father or his son, but they were all associated with anti-Semites and with anti-white racists. All of them associated with them and supported anti-white and anti-Semitic racists. Benjamin now writes, who invented the mothership story? Did Elijah Muhammad himself believe in it, or did Louis Farrakhan invent it after Elijah Muhammad died? I don't know the answer to that question, Benjamin. That I don't know. I know that in the story, Louis Farrakhan claims that Elijah Muhammad built the mothership, a spaceship over the flying over the earth that's going to suck up and destroy the entire white devil race. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Elijah Muhammad also told that story. I don't know who came up with that crazy story, but I don't know. I just don't know the answer. Is the story partial plagiarism from Judaism? We know that they copied Jacob and that they copied Jacob and turned him into Yaqub, who was an evil black scientist that invented the white race, 12 tribes of Israel, and a test tube. In Judaism, we believe that Eliyahu Hanavi will come back to announce the final redemption. The evil people will be destroyed. Did they copy Elijah the prophet into Elijah Muhammad in their theology and claim that whites are evil and be destroyed by Elijah Muhammad? Mm-hmm. I don't think that you can call that copying. The story is so different. The crazy story they came up with as opposed to the beautiful, our beautiful history. I mean, there's no comparison. I don't think so. The concept that evil people will be destroyed in Judaism, which is a Jewish concept, and that there'll be justice in the world, that's a concept that the Muslims and Christians and other religions did copy from. The only thing is, the people they define as evil are not evil, and the people they define as righteous are not righteous. Thank you very much, Binyamin. And we now go to the great Kahana Was Right, BT, who writes, and I quote, Te Chaim, how many Jews live in Ukraine? I don't know if anybody knows, because who's really Jewish, who's not really Jewish? There's so much intermarriage and assimilation there, and some people claim to be Jewish. I don't, and some people are. So there's some Jews who are hiding and claim to be Ukrainians. So I don't know the answer to that question. There could be, I don't know, it could be 20, 30, 40,000. I don't know how many there could be there. I have no idea. But as I mentioned in a previous question, I think that those who are there are completely insane. And Connor Was Right writes, are they in greater danger due to the Ukrainians or the invading Russians? Unquote. Well, of course they're in danger. First of all, anyone in Ukraine now is in danger because the Russians shell civilian areas and will murder people without any concern for human life. So, of course, and the Ukrainians also are barbarians. So, of course they're going to be in danger. You have to be, a Jew who lives there has to be completely nuts. Connor Was Right now writes, who are the neo-Nazis Putin keeps saying he's targeting? Unquote. Actually, the people Putin is targeting are neo-Nazis. And he talks about denazification, which never happened in Ukraine. And there actually are the Ukrainian people are a Nazi people who murdered huge numbers of Jews. So that happens to be true. The only thing is, Putin doesn't tell us the fact that the Russians also murdered huge numbers of Jews for centuries. And are just as Jew killing and Jew hating as anyone else. Connor Was Right now writes, how did a Jewish president Zelensky get elected in Ukraine? I thought this nation was highly anti-Semitic. Did their society change since World War II? Unquote. Great question, and the answer is no. This society did not change. Jews were also elected foreign minister and prime minister in countries like Germany, in Weimar Germany, or in France. Right before the Vichy Republic that collaborated fully with the Germans during World War II in France, you had Jews who were elected to the highest offices, prime minister, foreign minister, all types of offices. Anti-Semites will vote for Jewish politicians if they think that the Jew temporarily will do something good for their country. Anti-Semites will also vote for Jewish politicians. That doesn't mean that immediately after that they won't vote for a Hitler to exterminate all the Jews. That doesn't mean anything. It does not. Some Jews are impressed with the fact that the Jewish politicians get elected in certain places. You know, it happened in Germany before the Holocaust. It happened in France before the Holocaust. Then the French immediately started collaborating with the Jews. With the Germans. And the French police were the ones who rounded up French Jews and sent them to Auschwitz. It was not the German Nazis in France. It was the French Nazi collaborators, the French police, French soldiers, the French collaborators, they sent the Jews to the gas chambers and the ovens. The same French that elected a Jewish prime minister. So that doesn't mean anything. Austria, the ultimate Nazi country, elected Kreisky prime minister in the 1970s. Kreisky, the Jewish anti-Semite who hated Israel and was against the Jewish people and hated the Jewish people and supported all the Nazi war criminals. This is a Jew who supported the Nazi war criminals. Kreisky was elected the prime minister of Austria. That means the Austrians aren't a bunch of Nazis. Always were, always will be. So it's not. Zelensky was elected because the Ukrainians thought that. First of all, one of the reasons he was elected is because the Ukrainians believe that the Jews control all the Western countries and control the world. They believe all this Nazi ideology, and so they believe, let's get a Jewish prime minister here who, and this way we'll get foreign aid and we'll get support from the nations of the world. That was one of the motivations. Thank you, Kahana Was Right. And we go now to the great Dr. Dan, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, hope all is well. One, in the past you had mentioned that when Muslims fight each other, the U.S. should stay out of it and let them kill each other. What about Russia versus Ukraine in this day and age? Unquote. A great question, Dr. Dan, and I think the same thing should apply to Russia and Ukraine. The United States should stay out of it and will stay out of it. The United States is not going to get militarily involved here. First of all, this is in Russia's backyard. For the U.S. to send troops, they would be crazy in Russia's backyard. And secondly, Russia does have a huge nuclear arsenal. It's the United States is not going to directly go to war with Russia. That's just not going to happen. Dr. Dan now writes, and I quote, "Two, as it seems, the world is uniting against Russia in many different fronts. As things unfold, if crippling things happen to Russia, can you imagine what it would be like if God decided the world would unite against Israel on these same fronts? This is probably what it would feel like before the days of Mashiach in such a situation. Thank you, and God bless you and your family." Very good point, and yes, we're seeing an example of what happens when the world unites against a particular country, like Russia or like other countries that are facing sanctions and are facing world rebuke. Yes. That could easily happen to Israel. In some ways, it already has happened to Israel in the past. I mean, there have been times when the world was against Israel and was boycotting Israel and uniting against Israel. And most of the world today is involved in one way or another in a boycott of Israel. But yes, that is something that could eventually happen to Israel as well. No question about it. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And we now go to Zera Yisrael Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim. What are your thoughts on Yiddish Ladino revival currently going on?" Unquote. I have great respect for the Yiddish language, which my father, Alav Hashalom, Zichrono Livracha, his memory should live on, and peace should be upon him. My wonderful father was a speaker of very well educated, very high level Yiddish. And I have great respect for the Yiddish language, which our people in Europe spoke for 1,000 years. And Ladino is something that I grew up on. We spoke Ladino in my house because on my mother's side we're Sephardic Jews, and we spoke that language. But I do not believe that in this day and age, when we have the State of Israel, we should be reviving Yiddish or Ladino. Hebrew is the national language of the Jewish people. That is the language Jews should learn, Hebrew. And I don't believe the Yiddish or Ladino revival is going to go anywhere. These two languages are dead languages. The only people who speak Yiddish now are certain Hasidic group, Jews who live outside of Israel. But it's not a serious group of a serious block of Jews. It's a small group of Jews, and I don't know if it's in the tens of thousands. I don't know how much it is, but it's not a serious block in terms of the whole Jewish people. Hebrew is the language of the Jewish people, and that's what we should be focusing on, and that's the only language that's going to survive. Despite the fact that historically, before we had a Jewish state, when we were living in the exile, when we were living in the Galut, in the exile, then there was a need for languages like Yiddish and Ladino, and that's a different story. But now, we have our own homeland. We have our own country, and we should be speaking Hebrew. Zera Yisrael Kahanist now asks, "Have you prevented someone from intermarrying? If yes, tell how." I can't remember ever actually directly preventing anyone from intermarrying. I hope that all the years of broadcasting and speaking to people and all the activities we've done have prevented people from intermarrying. I hope so. I hope that we've reached Jews who maybe were on the verge of intermarrying and completely assimilating. I know that we have brought Jews back to Judaism. That we have done. There are numerous cases where that certainly has happened, but a case where someone was on the verge of intermarrying and I prevented it, or we did something to prevent it, I don't recall any specific case like that. Thank you very much, Zera Yisrael Kahanist. And now we go to Roi, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim. How about the deal of the Minister of Religion's Matan Kahana to repeal the grandson section in the law of return in exchange for civil marriage at consulates in Israel?" Well, of course, I'm in favor of repealing the grandson section in the law of return, which says that if you have a grandfather, even if you have a grandfather on the paternal side, even, you can claim to be a Jew under the law of return. That's not true. Jews should only be accepted as Jews al pi halacha, in accordance with Jewish law. That is what should be accepted. Nothing less than that. So of course I want to repeal that section of the law, but I do not support civil marriages in Israel. Civil marriages would be a disaster in Israel. We start having civil marriage, then of course we're going to have intermarriages, which will be sanctioned in Israel. And we're going to have homosexual marriages, which will be sanctioned in Israel. It would be a catastrophe. If people have to go to Kafrisin, to Cyprus, to get married and have to go through the trial. And there are Jews who will do that because they want a civil sarah. They want to, so they'll go. They go abroad when they want to get married. Let them have to go through the trouble. Yes, let them have to go through the trouble of doing that. In the Jewish state, we should not have civil marriages. And Roy now asks, what do you think of Yuli Edelstein as the new prime minister if Netanyahu signs a plea deal and the government falls and becomes a government with the ultra-Orthodox and other right-wing parties, unquote. I think Yuli Edelstein is a catastrophe. He's a fraud and a liar and an opportunist and a corrupt individual. And if he becomes prime minister, he'll be a disaster for Israel. He is not at all a right-wing Jew. Not at all. It would be very, very bad for Israel if he were prime minister. And I don't know if that's going to happen. I have my doubts if they would accept someone like him as prime minister. But not because he's bad. I mean, in Israel, they don't accept for other reasons. They may not accept him because he's from Russia. There's a lot of anti-Russian prejudice, unfortunately, in Israel. And that would be the wrong reason to reject somebody. Jews and our brothers and sisters in Russia are just as Jewish and just as much a part of the Jewish people as any other part of the Jewish people, and should be. And that should never be the reason. God forbid. We should not have sinat chinam, needless hatred against our fellow Jews. God forbid. But he's a bad guy. He has a bad history, and he's a bad guy. Roy now writes, and I quote, what do you think about a casino in Eilat where Israelis are not allowed to enter? Thanks. That's never going to happen, Roy. If you have a casino in Eilat, Israelis are going to enter, God forbid. That's never going to happen. Thank you, Roy. And Kahana will always be right, writes, and another good friend of ours writes, and I quote, comment on Jerry Springer, Maury Povich, Judge Judy, Oprah Winfrey. Okay, these are all television personalities who have shows on television. Every one of them is the lowest of the low. Jerry Springer, of course, that's the guy who had shows where he invited people on to, and they started fighting with each other on the show, physically fighting on the show and going crazy on the show. And he had the lowest of the low, the worst scum of the earth he would invite on his show and promote that as part of American culture. He is a self-hating Jewish piece of filth beyond description. Maury Povich, another intermarried, self-hating Jew, the lowest of the low as well, the scum of the earth. And the programs that he does on are the lowest of the low. I remember Maury Povich doing a program where he invited Arafat on his show and was kissing Arafat's behind. Just grotesque, a grotesque individual. Judge Judy, she's another big phony. I remember the last thing she became involved with was she was pushing Michael Bloomberg to run for president. He did, and thank God he lost disastrously. But that was Judge Judy's last great idea. She's so nasty. I don't know how anybody could watch her. She's so nasty. When she puts people through inquisitions on her program, I don't know why people enjoy watching that. She's just a nasty, vicious person. My father knew her because my father was a translator in the court system. So my father knew her, and I mean, she was just always a nasty, miserable, arrogant person. Oprah Winfrey, that stinking ugly Schwarza. She's probably a billionaire now. Can you believe this? They made her a billionaire. Another racist, vicious, hateful, jealous, disgusting person. You know, she was on the flight. She insisted that she should only have black stewardess on the flight. She would not accept any white stewardess. She doesn't want any white trash serving her on her flight. She insisted only black stewardesses. Yeah, she's another evil, horrific pig who was promoted and advanced solely because of the color of her skin. Thank you, Kahana will always be right. And now we go to another good friend of ours, Chabad Kahanes, who writes, and I quote, what is your take on the trial and execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg? And if they were Goyim or Wasps, in particular, would their lives have been spared? Was there an element of anti-Semitism in the trial, conviction, and execution? Unquote. Of course there was anti-Semitism involved, but that doesn't mean they didn't deserve it. They did deserve it. These were Jewish communists, open members of the Communist Party, who clearly were guilty. No question they were guilty. They and their whole family were involved with the communists, and with they helped Stalin. Stalin developed nuclear bombs, because the Russians didn't develop nuclear bombs on their own. They stole the system from the United States. And these vicious, self-hating traitors helped someone like Stalin, who wanted to murder and exterminate the entire Jewish people. Before Stalin died, he had a plan to commit a Holocaust against the Jews in the Soviet Union. God killed him just before he was able to perpetrate a Holocaust, literally a Holocaust against the Jews in Soviet Russia. And these beasts wanted to nuclearize Russia and give Russia all of America's nuclear weapons. The lowest of the low. They deserved to be executed 1,000 times over, 1,000,000 times over. The lowest of the low. If they were not Jewish, would they have been executed? There's a chance they would not have been. It's possible, because there was a lot of anti-Semitism associated with this. And by the way, all the Jews that always say that we, the Kahanish Jews, cause anti-Semitism, which is a lie. We do not cause anti-Semitism. We're one of the only groups of Jews that even the anti-Semites respect. But this sludge, this slime, this communist slime, what they did, that doesn't cause any, that really causes anti-Semitism. And all the Jews had big demonstrations. You know, there were mass demonstrations and marches for the Rosenbergs. Jews marching and demonstrating and fighting for them and doing things for them that they didn't do for the 6 million during the Holocaust. Doing for these two commie, filthy, rat, low-life traitors. Thank you, Chabad Kahanist. And we now go to another good friend of ours, the great Italian Zionist, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, I'm proud to announce that my DNA test shows that I have Sephardic genes. My guess is I am part of the Sephardic diaspora that fled Spain and went to Italy. They even discovered old synagogues close to my grandmother's town. I knew there was a reason I was always mistaken for Israeli or Jewish. I understand it does not make me Jewish by religion, but I am proud to descend from such an amazing people. With this knowledge, I feel a certain sense of strength and power, and I feel closer to the heroes of the Bible, such as Moses and Samson. Your thoughts," unquote. Italian Zion is wonderful. That's wonderful news, and doesn't surprise me, because you're a very smart guy, and doesn't surprise me at all, knowing you. You're a smart guy, and you're also a very moral person and a wonderful human being. And, you know, and I know you, I mean, I know you for how many years you used to come to our meetings when we had monthly meetings even 10 or 11 years ago. I think I know you for more than that. I think I know you probably for 12, 13, 14 years. And and you certainly are a great person, and we're very happy to have you on our forum, and we're very happy to be in touch with you. Thank you, Italian Zionist. And we go now to Am Raphael, who always asks great questions and writes, and I quote, "Good evening, Chaim. What wine do you drink? What's your favorite car brand?" As long as the wine is kosher, you know, wine has to be kosher, because wine is something that has to be kosher. There's certain liquors that don't have to be kosher. Whiskey and vodka, scotch, all of these really hard liquors, they don't have to be. And beer doesn't have to be kosher. But wine does have to be. And as long as the wine is kosher and not too sweet. I don't like when sugar is added to things. It's very unhealthy. Sugar is unhealthy, and we should not be adding sugar to things. There are natural sugars, of course, in fruits and vegetables. So I certainly get my share of it because I eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. But when sugar is added to products, I don't like that. I don't like that in wine either. So as long as no sugar is added and it's kosher, I like all wine. I'm not picky. I don't have a particular. I mean, the brand I drink now is called Kedem, which is not an expensive brand and not a fancy brand. But to me, it doesn't make a difference. And I only drink wine, by the way, on Shabbat or on holidays. I never touch liquor if it's not Shabbat. Shabbat is the Sabbath, or Hachagim, or the holidays. Am Raphael asked me about my favorite car brand. I think the best buy are the Japanese cars. They make the highest quality cars, and the price is the best price. American cars are notoriously unreliable and not good cars, because of affirmative action and because of they took over the assembly lines in Detroit and everything else, and they put incompetent morons on these lines. And so cars, the Fords, my poor father, Alav HaShalom, he should rest in peace, always used to buy Ford because he thought that American brand is going to be, and the Ford, even though I don't know if he even knew later on, I told him after he had already bought it, after he had bought it and was driving it for several years, that Ford was a vicious anti-Semite. But he would buy Ford, and they always broke down on him. On the other hand, people in my family, I don't drive, but people in my family who bought the Toyotas or who bought Camrys, Hyundai, and these other brands, they last a lot longer and they're much more reliable, generally speaking. So I think those are the smart car buyers buy Japanese, in my opinion. Thank you, I'm Rafael, and now we go to Joe Brandon, who always has something interesting to say and who writes, and I quote: "One, are we the closest we've been to nuclear war since the Cuban Missile Crisis? I don't think so. I don't think that Russia is going to start a nuclear war. Putin's behavior is like Soviet-like behavior here. This is the type of behavior we saw from the Soviet Union. But the Soviets were not suicidal. They had an ideology. They were very cruel, very sadistic people, very brutal people, and dangerous people. Dangerous, and Putin is a dangerous person. But they're not suicidal. And nuclear war would be suicidal. So I don't think we're closer to a nuclear war. No, I think that Putin is bluffing when he threatens nuclear. He hints that there's a danger of nuclear war and that he's creating a nuclear alert. It's all a bluff. And the Soviets always did that too. They always threatened the possibility of nuclear war. Always, it was a bluff. They're not suicidal. Joe now writes, and I quote, "Two, how does the Flintstones parable, namely, what would you call the Flintstones if they were black niggers, explain what is happening in Ukraine?" I have no idea how it would explain what's happening in Ukraine, except that these drunken anti-Semites sometimes remind me of Schwarzes. The Ukrainians, the Poles, their behavior is almost on that level sometimes. The Russian army, which fought heroically against the Germans in World War II, even though they lost 25 million, 30 million people. But when people come and invade Russia, the Russians do resist very, very ferociously. But when it comes to invading other countries, the Russians are not very effective fighters. And one of the reasons is because of massive alcoholism and now drug addiction. They're just not effective because many Russians are drug addicts or alcoholics. Many of them. And so they lost in Afghanistan disastrously. You see in Ukraine, they're not, even though they heavily outnumber the Ukrainians and have much greater weaponry, they're having a tough time doing what they wanted to do in Ukraine. And we saw the Russians unable to win. Ron from Israel reminded me that the Russians were unable to defeat a little country like Finland when they attacked Finland many years ago. And even in the 1905 war against Japan, little Japan gave Russia a real shellacking in the beginning, and the Russians were unable to. Everybody thought Russia would easily defeat Japan in the 1905 Russian-Japanese war, but the Russians in fact had a very hard time even going back to 1905. So there's a long history of this. But anyway, thank you, Joe, and I want to thank everybody for another program. Another program that we did of Ask JTF, something which I always enjoy doing. I always enjoy speaking to our great JTFers. Remember, we're giving you a chance to change history here. Be part of it. Help us. Join with us. Let's fight together to make a difference here. If we work together as a team, we can change Jewish history and we can make this a better world. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.